All right, folks, welcome to the February March Mike and Scotty live show. And sitting in for Scott these months, I guess I should say, since it's a 2 month podcast, is our old friend Craig Biesgeier. How are you, Craig?
Hello, I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
Welcome aboard. Craig's one of those guys who is always willing to lend a hand when it comes to having a friendly discussion on a podcast, and Scott wanted to send along his thank yous for that. He's got big fish to fry and some family things going on and some work things going on, and he's busy mentally in the Grapefruit League down in Florida, so you know what I mean. He's just not here, but we are, and that's what counts, damn it.
That's for sure.
So, Craig, you're one of the busiest guys I know.
okay.
Well, you are. I mean, you know, the world seems to be divided between people who do a lot of stuff and people who don't. And you're one of the do-it people, I think.
Okay, I'd like to think that. That sounds nice.
At least if I can judge it by what you put on Facebook, I can, you know, can I take that at face value?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, one thing is I don't like to sit still. I mean, my wife hates it because her favorite thing in the summertime is to go to the beach. And if I go with her, I'm sitting there the whole time thinking to myself, oh, my God, there's so many things I could be doing other than sitting here and getting sunburned.
You know? shoot me in the face. I think I'll take that instead. My previous wife was a big beach person. And the only way I could do the beach is if I had some shade, like a palm tree, and preferably some kind of beverage and a really good book.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That does sound pretty good.
That I didn't mind, but just to sit there and broil, that's just not me.
Yeah, not me either. You know, so yeah, my mind's running 1,000 miles a second in that situation going, I could be doing this, I could be doing that.
Yep.
So I would much rather, you know, be at home in the basement or working with my 3D printer or whatever else. You know, I mean, it's just anything. I like doing things. I like making things. So,
yep. You know. It's a creative thing.
And exactly.
And fortunately, Karen, the love of my life, is just like me, except maybe even more so. And she likes nothing better than a day to just kind of do her thing, you know. And
oh, I do.
Yeah. So that's, you know, we're a good match in that regard. Your wife is Karen too, isn't she?
She is. That is correct.
Yeah. Maybe it's a Karen thing. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, she's not really into the whole train thing at all, but she's very good about letting me have time and space in order to work on projects.
And neither is my Karen, although she's got a good eye. And there have been more than one times where I bring her downstairs and I show her something and I say, there's something about this that I don't like and I can't put my finger on it, but maybe you can. And because she's got a good eye, she's got sort of an artist's eye, she can look at something and say, that's not the right color, or the proportion of that is not in sync, or the viewing angle of this needs to be a little different. You know what I mean? She always comes up with something immensely useful. So I'm really looking forward to the point where I can start asking her for that kind of advice again.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I know I do that with my wife sometimes because, as you may or may not remember, I'm somewhat colorblind. And
I
so whenever
that.
I do any scenery, I'm lost. And so I'll often have her over my shoulder going, okay, yeah, put that there. Don't use that. Use this one instead.
Right. And now you've been traveling all over the place, right? You've been, I don't know how many different, weren't you in like Minnesota or something during the cold snap, or Milwaukee, or
Detroit, actually.
Detroit. Okay.
Yeah, I was in Detroit and it was like, at one point it was 14 degrees below zero. What fun that was.
all of these places from my benefit, and I'm sorry to any listeners who are above that point, but for me, they're just above the Arctic Circle, you know.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. They're right there, you know. I mean, I think I saw Santa going by, you know, at one point, so it was pretty cold.
And Detroit, I guess, can be a tough place weather-wise, just in general. So to go to go there in the midst of something especially bad must have been especially nice.
Oh, it was just wonderful. I mean,
and you're trying to fly during this weather. You're trying to get back and forth to the place that you're working in, which in your case is usually some kind of major warehouse, right?
That's right. Yep. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting. Actually, when I was there with a colleague of mine who seems to, I'm known for being an aggressive driver, and this
no,
guy,
you're from New Jersey.
I know, right?
How is that possible?
You know, it's just amazing. I don't know. But this guy, apparently, and nobody knew it when we got in the car with him, but he has two speeds, like with the accelerator on and off. And so it's like icy roads, and he's driving a minivan, and every time it's just the tires are spinning, and you know, things are, it's like, we're all going to die.
Yeah. If you were 18, you might've enjoyed it more.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But now I'm much more cognizant of my mortality, and it was a little bit scary, but we all lived through it, which was good. And you know, it was interesting. We got there, and the weather had been good on the landing and everything like that. And then as soon as I got to the rental car counter, it started to snow. And so all the other guys had gotten out before me, and they got to the site in about 25 minutes. It took me over an hour.
Did you get an all-wheel drive?
I did not. I asked for one, and they laughed at me.
They were gone.
They were all gone. Yeah, you just, there's no way.
That's the only vehicle I ever used to rent when I used to go rail fanning, because I was always, you know, out in the desert someplace or in the mountains or mm-hmm. wherever. Oh, yeah.
No, they gave me a Toyota Corolla. That was exciting.
There you go. There's a winter car.
But yeah, so I was there, and then a couple of weeks ago, I was down in Houston, Texas, and that was actually very nice in the middle of winter. It was about 70 degrees and quite pleasant.
Yeah, beats having to go there in the middle of the summer, because I think they have about 150% humidity in the summer, don't they?
Oh, yeah, they do, and I've done that too. Last time I was down there a couple of years ago, it was in the middle of summer, and it was about, I remember at one point, it was 2:30 in the morning, and it was 92 degrees. I'm like, this is not right.
Gosh, you know, I had one rail fanning trip. They, you know, you're going to Houston in the summer. My buddy Dave and I did the sunset route on the SP in it was either late August or early September, and this is probably not the ideal time to be in the desert. During the day, the thermometer in the car said 117 degrees. Ooh. So what we would do is we would hop out of the car, leave it running, take a picture, jump back into the car.
Get back to the air conditioning.
Well, every time you open the car door, it was like opening the oven to check on your pizza.
You know, sure.
It was that kind of feeling.
Except throw the pizza.
Right. And when we got to Yuma late that night, you know, we had been out in the heat all day, and we checked into the hotel and all that, and they had a pool. And we thought, oh, let's jump in the pool and cool off. Never once thinking that the pool had been out in the heat all day as well.
Oh yeah.
You jump in the pool, and it was basically like a bathtub. I mean, it was it was warm water. It wasn't even tepid. It wasn't even refreshing, really.
Exactly what I was going to say. Not even refreshing. No.
And the fact that it was 105 at night probably had something to do with that. Also, I don't know how people do it, you know.
I really don't either. I mean,
New England
I
has a reputation for terrible weather, and
oh yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, it can be, but it's also sort of moderate. You know what I mean? It's fairly temperate. And I don't think Jersey is that much different,
right? You know.
Yeah. Well, sometimes the Mid-Atlantic gets a lot of things we don't too. You know,
it's
funny how things track.
Oh yeah.
And speaking of track, how's that for a segue?
But
I'm jumping around a little bit, but I don't have Mr. Mason here to sort of, you know, keep things in order. So I actually broke out a post-it note and jotted down some thoughts a good 5 or even 10 minutes before the podcast.
Nice.
So the top thing on my list says, check the old agenda so I know where we last left off. But you know what? I didn't do that. And if I don't remember, I'm gambling that most of our listeners don't remember either.
Yeah, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, so go
right ahead. Well, when you get old.
Wait, I thought I was old.
Yeah, no, it's all relative, man. I'm telling you. I'm going to be 63 in July.
Oh, boy. God bless you.
And what I'm finding is that the old knowledge is still very much intact.
Mm-hmm.
What I see all too often is I'm thinking about something. I walk into a room, and then it's like, all right, what the hell am I in here for?
Oh, yeah. Why did I come in here? Exactly.
Yeah. Which is probably how it begins, you know. So I'm trying to get as much done as I can before it gets too bad. The layout update is probably something that should be addressed, I think.
Okay.
Just to review, and I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to any of the 2019 podcasts, but I had my last op session early in January, and then immediately moved towards getting things happening out in the new layout room. And you've been here before, so you may remember that I had that big staging yard and Pitston yard on top of it, and that Pitston yard was removed from the staging yard, and the staging yard is now on legs out in the new room. And my buddy Dave and I have built all kinds of bench work. I mean, it's amazing how fast the bench work is going up. It really helps to have a second person.
Oh, it really does.
Dave just retired, you know, so he's
Oh,
kind of
even
like,
better.
yeah, he's kind of like Dave on tap. And so normally I would, there were all the two man stuff, I would kind of save up until he came over on train night, which is usually Monday nights when he was working. And now I can get him over, you know, two, sometimes three times a week, which greatly accelerates
Oh,
that whole
yeah, you're gonna
process.
fly.
And we had socked in a lot of supplies. I had plenty of plywood and just a lot. I think I brought in, I don't know, 60 or 70 one by fours that we went out to the lumber yard and hand picked. And I had giant boxes of star drive construction screws. I mean, I was really just ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
And the most important thing was I had cleaned up and organized my workshop,
What's that
which,
like?
well, it's really good. Really, really, really good. And the only bad thing about it is you feel like an idiot for waiting that long to clean it up, because I'm so immensely productive in it now. It's embarrassing to think of the time I wasted looking for tools, moving stuff, you know,
Oh
just,
gosh.
it's
Yeah,
just.
I mean, I'm like probably half the other modelers out there. I have a square about 8 inches by 8 inches on my workbench where I manage to do everything
Sure.
because it's everything else is just covering the workbench. You can't
It's a
get to it.
cliche for a reason, because I think that when you think about it, right, you're working on a project. Let's say I'm doing installs, right? I mean, everybody
Sure.
knows I do tons of sound installs here. And I have a new model shop here, which I bet you'd get a kick out of seeing. You know,
Oh, I'm looking forward to it, yeah.
actually, maybe you can think about swinging by when you come up for the New England meet or something. You know what I mean?
I would love to.
I'm hoping to have a mini open house around that time, so that anybody that was interested can come by and just kind of check things out. But the new model shop is about 1,000,000,000% better than the old.
Well, the old one was a little tiny desk, if I remember.
So it's not hard. I
Yeah.
understand what you're saying. The new one has that tiny desk with a lot of stuff not on it,
Oh, good.
and everything around it sort of arranged. But you know what? You're doing an install. You're working in about an 18-inch square. You know what I
Oh, yeah.
mean? Because
Oh, yeah.
everything you need has to be within arm's reach, and everything you're working on, you're not going to scatter it around the room. So, I mean, you know,
Well,
that's
hopefully not, no.
right. The only thing I have noticed is that the way the bench is set up now, if I'm working on, you know, sometimes people send me multiple engines, and sometimes they're the same model locomotive.
Okay.
Like the other day, I out of the order of five from one customer came in, there were two F45s. Well, I worked on the two F45s pretty much at the same time.
Okay.
I can burn two chips at a time because there's two PCs there, and there's enough room on the bench from an organizational standpoint that I can open up and work on two locomotives at the same time. So if there's weights to be milled, I mill those at the same time. You know what I mean? So there's an economy of scale there that you know, you don't do it in half the time, but there, you know, you do save some time
Oh, sure.
by doing that, you know. And anything you're figuring out on the first loco, you already know on the next one. You know what I mean? So
Absolutely.
that's been helpful. But you know, the workshop also has a brand new dust collection system in it, which means that I can work fairly cleanly,
Okay.
and it's adjacent to the model shop, so that's kind of important. So we just, you know, we knocked off this bench work, and the bench work basically goes all around the outside walls of the new addition. And we've also put all the bench work in to replace where the staging yard used to be in the old basement opposite Mehoopany there. That whole area behind there is all brand new bench work.
Oh, cool.
So, and I've also built the bench work in the former oil tank room, which you go through the concrete wall to get to, and that is the route of the main line going to staging. So it became obvious that I needed to get going on the gate or bridge sooner than later. So I did. I sat down one Saturday morning and basically drew it up and gave it to a welder I know. And this guy had proved his mettle working on my old Kubota, doing some things for me.
Is that a pun there? Proved his mettle because he's a welder?
Jeez, you know, you caught that, huh? it didn't hurt that he's the only welder I know. So he was a leading candidate, but he was a good guy. He's one of these guys that you can work with and work cooperatively with in a creative way. So I thought he would be really the right guy to work with on this particular project. And he decided he wanted to come by and see the spot and went through the whole thing and looked at it. And I said, you know, ballpark, what are we talking about? He said, well, you know, if I'm just going to do this, I'm going to need a helper. And, you know, I'm going to be totally responsible for all the decision making on this. And you know, there's going to be even more questions to ask you. He says, it's probably going to cost you about $1,200.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm thinking, it's more than I wanted to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what else you got? And he said, well, he said, I'm glad you asked. He said, if you want to come out and work with me on the project, I'll charge you $50 an hour plus materials, and I'll bet we can knock this off expeditiously. And I said, you're on.
That's a much better deal.
So the day that we were supposed to start, he said, when do you want this? I said, I want this thing in place by the end of this month. So, and this was 2 weeks ago.
Really?
So I went out there on a Wednesday afternoon, colder than Detroit, okay?
That's pretty cold.
Yes. And I had on every layer that I could think of, and yet still move around. I almost looked like one of those characters on South Park, you know. With the ski park on. And that's because he has a shop. It was heated, but the material comes in 24-foot lengths, I think he got it in. And we were using 1-inch.
Angle iron or?
No, square tubing.
Square tubing, okay.
So all of that got cut out in his driveway with a chop saw and a cutoff wheel.
Okay.
A lot of sparks, but actually it was surprisingly easy to make the cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of the welding was done on a big steel table he had in back of his shop.
Mm.
This table was probably about 8x8, and it was 3/4 inch thick solid steel.
Mm. Yeah, well.
Wasn't going anywhere.
Talk about a boat anchor. Hmm.
Yeah, but it made a very good flat surface to clamp things down on.
Oh, sure,
on.
Yeah.
You know, he
I'm
just
sure
puts
it was
the ground clamp on the table itself, basically, and then just,
mm-hmm.
you know, welds away.
So now you were doing arc welding then?
Not me personally.
Not you.
I was, okay. You know.
The royal we, yeah.
Yeah, helping him make decisions, figure things out, confirm dimensions, grind welds, anything but the actual welding, you know.
Right. Now, not to get off track, but I wanted to ask, for this bridge, are we talking about a lift out or a gate? What are we getting at here?
That's the right question. Glad you asked. I've had lift out bridges in the past, and I've had drop bridges that I've made in the past, and mm-hmm. all of them have worked relatively well. Now, when you make something out of wood, even when you're running a dehumidifier, you're going to have humidity expansion in the summer.
Sure.
And
you can't help it.
Conversely, you know, extreme contraction in the driest part of the winter. So what that basically means is spring and fall, your gates or your bridges work great.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summertime, I can remember before one op session actually having to get out the palm sander and sand the end of the bridge so I could get it, you know, into place, which is not ideal.
Not so much.
And the thing is, in both cases, those were in a location where you'd come in from the outside and then be immediately at that bridge. So you really couldn't put it up until everybody was in for the op session. And then if somebody had to go to their car for something, they had to crawl under the gate. I mean, it just wasn't ideal, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And when I did this particular addition and the new layout plan, there was a lot of attention was paid to how people move around in an op session. And then you've got your walk paths coming in from outside and get to the model shop and all of that. And I played with a million designs and kept coming back to one where everything kind of funneled through one spot, and it had to be something that was easy to open and close.
Sure.
So this particular gate has two levels, or it will have two levels. Right now it's just one.
Okay.
And on the bottom level, there are three tracks going across it, and on the top level, there will be a single track going across it. So I'm going to have four tracks on two different levels coming from three different directions that are always in perfect alignment, and people need to be able to open and close this thing constantly during an op
So
session.
you're a masochist, aren't you?
It was the only way to do it. It just, you know, and because we're not getting any younger, and because the last time I was up at Confalone's, on the last duck under at his place, I found a way to slice about a quarter-sized piece of scalp off my head on the leg
Oh,
of his layout.
and guys like you or me, we got no protection.
Nothing. You know, it's I basically grabbed a napkin and went upstairs to his wife and said, "Nurse."
Yeah, been there, done that.
So, well, actually, I went to the dermatologist a couple of weeks ago, and she looked at the top of my head and she said, "Jeez." And I said, "I know.
That's not good.
It's it, I just, you know, it, once my close vision went, I have no idea where my head is, and I know when it hits something."
I hear you. We actually have an expression for it. We call it getting coin slotted.
I like that.
Yeah.
I have to remember that. That's not trademarked, is it?
No, feel free to
Okay.
use it.
Okay. So I came up with a design that was a gate. And because it's a gate and because it needs to be, you know, wider than 4 inches, it couldn't be a rectangle because
Right.
you couldn't swing it. It had to be some kind of, was that a trapezoid?
Yep,
It's a
absolutely.
weird shape. On the top, and because of that, there's some cantilevering to the support of the top, and I just said, you know what, the only way to do this is with steel. So I came up with a design, mocked it up on the floor with tape and, you know, pieces of wood that were screwed together, just testing it as best as I could, watching the swings and all of that. I didn't want the opening to be less than 36 inches because that's sort of the ruling width, if you will, for
Sure.
all the doorways here.
And a good width it is.
But because of that, that's the small end of the trapezoid, so the larger end has to be wider. It was 40, like 3 inches or something like that.
Okay.
So it wasn't unsubstantial. And
Right.
by making it out of steel, my thought was, designed properly, it's not going to rack, it's not going to sag. So I went to
Yes,
Home
that
Depot
the
and
wall might, but
well, I'm getting to that.
okay.
There is no wall that's going to affect this gate.
Okay.
I went to Home Depot looking for hinges for it because I wanted the hinges welded on. So before I went out there, I had to get the hinges, and you know they have you know crappy, better, and better than that kind of hinges. I ended up with these industrial ball bearing hinges,
Okay.
which I've never personally used before. But I'm telling you, if you've got something heavy that you want to open smoothly,
Like a bank vault,
get a yes, get a ball
but
bearing hinge. I'm telling you,
okay.
you could open this gate like with your pinky.
Nice.
It's amazing. So you're right about the wall and all of that stuff. So not only did we build a gate, but we built a hinge post
Okay.
and a latch post, both of which are welded to quarter inch steel plate that is screwed and bolted to the concrete floor.
Wow.
So
Okay.
there's nothing about it that relies on connections to the wall or to the house or to wood.
You really went all the way, didn't you?
Listen, you know, I'm serious about this gate.
Really, I hadn't noticed.
You know, it was one of those things, and I talked to some of the guys about it, and I had also looked online. There's a company, and the name escapes me, but he offers gate kits made out of this slotted aluminum extrusions that you can kind of screw together with all
Yep.
these different fittings. And I mean, those things were in the $500-ish range, and it's a kit and not really custom. And I didn't see any way to make it as a trapezoid. So, but it kind of told me what kind of price point I sort of wanted to be in.
Right.
And I mean, the bottom line was it cost me more than $500, but way less than $1,200. And once I got it and got it in place and I started to use it, I thought, you know what? This is something I'm going to use for the rest of my hopefully long life, and it's going to get used a lot during an op session, and the freaking thing works perfectly.
I
It
can't ask
just
for more than that.
it's just I put it in place, I installed it with my buddy Dave. The hardest part of it really was drilling the holes in the concrete and then trying not to shear off the tapcons,
Oh yeah, I hear you.
But I only broke two of them, I think. It turned out the best way to do it is to put it in with a hand ratchet so you can kind of tell when they're getting a little gimpy,
Oh yeah.
and then you back it right out and put in a fresh one,
Yep, oh yeah.
But that thing, I'm telling you, you could hang off of this thing. And I used 1.5 inch rigid foam as the top,
Okay.
and I just glued it right to the metal with power grab.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, I don't know how you'd get it off of this thing at this point.
Nice.
And I tried to align it as best as I could, and then where the tracks come in, I'm just gonna belt sand it a little bit to get it exactly even with the cork coming in. And I'm gonna lay the track right across it, and then take a Dremel and cut the gaps where the gate opens.
Excellent.
So I'll be doing that pretty soon, actually. Possibly as soon as this week.
Okay. Wow. That's I can't wait to see it. That sounds amazing.
And I've got Mike Confalone coming down next week to help Dave and I, and the goal for that is going to be to get Pittston Yard back on top of the staging yard.
All right.
And with that in place, I can then proceed to finish connecting up the Lehigh line to the old layout. And my goal, such as it is to have the ability to have at least a test op session in June. I think it's doable.
Oh, I think based on the way that you work, I think that's plenty of time.
We'll see. I find that track laying is like the one thing you can't rush. It just takes what it takes
That's true.
to do it
Yeah, because
right anyway.
well, that's the thing. If you rush it, you're going to get kinks, you're going to get dips, and it's just going to, make you crazy later on. So you might as well take your time and get it done right.
Absolutely. Now you are sort of an inventor, aren't you?
Well, I'm definitely a frustrated engineer. There's no doubt about that.
I saw your penny holding bracket for car
Oh,
weights.
you saw that, huh?
Talk about
Okay.
that a little bit. That's
All
interesting.
right. Well, let's see. So, most of who have listened to me in the past on our show and on here on Mike and Scotty show, that I do a lot of building of let's see, resin kits and other things like that, especially because of the period that I modeled.
Right.
Because there's nothing available, so you're either making resin models or you're making laser cut kits or whatever like that, because there's no other way to do it.
I bet S-scalers have more than you do.
I think they might actually, yeah. So, one of the things that I normally do when I'm putting a car together in HO scale is a lot of people have a lot of different things they use for car weights. Some people use a nice piece of 1 inch wide steel, and they'll cut it to length and glue it to the floor. I know people that use nuts, like nut and bolt nuts, washers. I've always used pennies.
I think the branch line kits used to come with nuts that you would just glue in place.
Yeah, and I think that the Tichy cars used to have an indentation in the floor that was made for like a 3/4 inch nut or something
Interesting.
like that. So it was like a little hexagonal thing. It's like, you put nut here.
Interesting. I always use the automotive stick-on weights, like useful for wheel balancing.
Yep. And those work great. There's nothing wrong with that.
And lead shot, if I have to like pour it into some place, lead
Oh yeah,
shot
lead
was
shot
great
is
for
the
that.
best. Yeah. And it really is. There's nothing better than that, really. But
Well, I haven't been able to find depleted uranium, so yeah.
Well, yeah, until we find a steady source of that, we're kind of stuck. So anyway, but one of the things I've always used is pennies. And so what I'll normally do is I'll just take a couple of stacks of 5 pennies, which is about a half an ounce per, because it works out that pennies are about one-tenth of an ounce. It's close. It's not perfect, but it's
Yep.
close. So I'll take a couple of stacks of those, five of the, and then I'll glue them to the floor in the car in order to get the weight that I need. Because they're readily available. I don't have to go out and, source them someplace or anything else like that. And frankly, they cost pennies a piece. So they're cheap. But one of the things that I've always had issues with is every now and then you'll end up with a car that takes a tumble, not necessarily from the layout to the floor, but just gets rolled over
Sure.
or. And sometimes I've noticed that depending on the glue that I used, the stacks of pennies can become unglued.
Well, I wanted to ask you what you were using for bonding them.
I've used a number of different things. I've used super glue. I've used goo, Walther's goo. One thing I really like using is actually caulk,
Yep.
adhesive caulk. I think that works the best.
Like DAP. I mean,
Exactly.
I've become a fan of doing that for holding down track, believe it or not.
Oh, I do that too. Absolutely. It's great because it's easily removable. You just take a putty knife with a sharp edge, you slide it right between the ties and the roadbed, and it comes right up.
But it does not let go otherwise.
No, it doesn't. And the other nice thing about it, which I know you'll appreciate based on what you were saying about 10 minutes ago, is that it actually helps keep the track from kinking because it will give a little bit. If the benchwork shrinks,
Sure.
the caulk will actually give a tiny bit in order to help keep it from kinking up.
When I had heard about it at first, I kind of raised an eyebrow, but it's proven itself, and in fact, I'm confident enough in it that I'm using it to hold down any of the new track that I'm putting into the staging yard that's going to have a layer on top of it. So, that would make maintenance very problematic if I needed it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I think you'll have good luck with it. I've had certainly a good luck with it on mine. But anyway, getting back to the penny cage, my thought on it was, I've been doing all this work with the 3D printer lately.
Right.
And I thought, well, I happened to be sitting at work the other day and we're not terribly busy right now. My mind was kind of wandering to projects. And I thought, well, gee, what if I were to make something that we're able to hold several stacks of pennies in place and then like basically keep them so that even if you glue them together, should it become loose, it won't cause, because if the pennies shift and they go to one side, it can cause the card to, tend to tilt or derail, and that's never a good thing. So,
I've actually seen that happen. In
oh, I
fact,
have too.
at the last op session up at Confalone's, he had it was the funniest thing. It was a tank car that he had shoved some of those weights, those automotive weights into, but
Okay.
they had gone off center.
Uh-oh.
So you'd put the car on the track and it would sit there and then it would just fall over like Benny Hill.
Oh, that's funny.
And you'd think, wait a minute, that's not possible.
Yeah, that shouldn't happen.
Right.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, but so anyway, what I did was I just took about, I don't know, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes once I got home, and I just created a simple cage. That would allow you to stack a few pennies in line, and then it has a lid that goes onto it that you can glue down. It keeps them all together. And at the bottom, on the piece that you glued down to the car floor, it's got some tabs that extend out to either side to help keep that cage centered in the car.
Yeah.
So even if that should become unglued, it will still not move to one side or the other. And I
Boy.
thought, this is really useful. I can use this on so many things. But then I was thinking, I posted it on Facebook to show people what I'd done. And of course, people were like, what are you going to sell this? I'm like, well, I can't imagine anybody buying it because the whole
Oh, come
point
on.
of
You're going to be able to quit your job now.
I wish. But I mean, okay, the whole idea is you're cheap. You're using pennies for weight, but then you got to buy, what, $1 for this thing to keep the pennies in? How's, nobody's going to do that. That's crazy. So I put it up on there's a site called Thingiverse that's run by MakerBot, and people of load all different kinds of projects up to that site. And so what I did was I loaded it up there. And now anybody who's interested in it can find it there. If you've got a 3D printer, you can actually download the file for it and print it yourself. There's even ways up there that you can have them printed for you. You can that either, I'm not exactly sure how that works, but you know, there's certainly things that can be done that way.
Right.
So then that's just something I threw together in a couple of hours, you know, just to solve a problem that I didn't even really have. But
well, when you have, I mean, you're a developer, so you have programming chops. And that enables you to basically use your 3D printer to create anything you can conceive of.
Right.
I could see the attraction to that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, the other thing, since we're on the subject, beyond that, I've been doing a lot of stuff lately in the last couple of months working on actual models to run on the railroad, you know, boxcar models. And that was something when I first got started with this, it was a goal that I had that I've been working towards for quite a while. And it's one thing to be able to download things from a site like Thingiverse where you can make, you know, get a cup holder or, you know, a handle for something or a knob, you know, that somebody else has designed and uploaded. But one of the goals that I had for with this 3D printer was to be able to make my own tools, my own models, things like that.
Sure.
And it's complicated by the fact that the printer that I have is an entry-level printer, and it's not really the highest resolution.
Well, it must be slow also, right?
Well, that's part of it, yeah. The 3D printing process in general is very slow. But one of the things that I've learned over time is that there's a few things that you can do to really improve the resolution, even on a inexpensive printer. And those things are, you can take the nozzle, which is where the plastic shoots out of the hot end, because what happens is that there's a plastic filament that gets fed into here, and it gets squished through this very fine hole
yep.
at the bottom, and it deposits it first on a build plate, and then after it's done the perimeter of whatever it needs to do, it goes up a slight bit and deposits the next layer and continues to go until it completes the model. So one of the first things you can do to really improve things is to make the nozzle size smaller. Okay, so you have much finer control of what you're actually doing. Okay, most 3D printers come with a 0.40 nozzle. That's a 0.4 millimeters, so that's less than half a millimeter. That's pretty small.
Right.
But what I've been working with lately, I actually got some finer nozzles that are 0.25 millimeters, so a quarter of a millimeter.
How does that help? Because it's kind of counterintuitive. You'd think the smaller the nozzle, the less it would put out, and the bigger, I mean, the longer it would take. Is that true?
That is exactly true. In fact, because the nozzle is less than half, it's a little more than half the diameter, but if you think about it in terms of the area, it's actually putting out about a fourth of the amount of plastic that a 0.4 nozzle is, okay? The 0.4 nozzle is considerably more flow going through it. But the reason it becomes better resolution is that as the printer is going, it's laying down a very narrow strip of plastic, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're putting down a strip of plastic that's only 0.25 millimeters wide, it's going to take you twice as long, okay, in order to lay down a wall the same width
sure.
for a model as it would with the larger nozzle. And that's just in one dimension. And when you start talking about then moving across it in the two dimensions, now you're talking about four times longer in order to fill up an area the same thing.
Yep.
So that increases the time right there. That's a main thing. But you get, because it's laying down much finer a layer of plastic, you can actually get it to, like for instance, here's an example. I actually made about 4 or 5 months ago, I did a model of a DPM arched window for one of those DPM kits that we all have.
Yes.
And I wanted a different look to it. The ones that come with the kit are basically a two-pane window, and that doesn't work for me because in my period, you wouldn't have very large windows like that.
You'd
have
right.
windows with a lot of individual lights, a lot of mullions and things like that. So I wanted to make a different window in order to be able to put into a model that I was working on. And so what I did was I took the basic dimensions of it, put it into the program that I use in order to build models, and I created it. And the first time I tried to print it, it came out and looked exactly like a regular DPM window. And I'm like, what the heck happened? I don't understand. So I'm looking at it and looking at it, and I realized, oh, you know what it is? I made the muntins too small. Okay. I made them look really good in the program.
Okay.
But actual 0.4 millimeter nozzle couldn't resolve it. It's too large for that size. The muntins were only 0.3 millimeters. And the 0.4 millimeter nozzle, the slicer program that does this couldn't resolve it, so it left them out.
Yep.
Okay, and so, but now I'm printing with a much smaller nozzle. I can actually get that finer detail now.
Now, that window that you printed, how long did it take to print that?
With a 0.4 nozzle, it took about 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Not too bad. I printed 20 of them. It took about, yeah, I don't know, an hour, like that. If I were to go back and reprint them now with the smaller nozzle, it would easily take 3 hours, if not more.
Yep.
Okay, so that's one thing. Second thing is that a lot of times, and one of the reasons people don't like 3D printing at this point, and it's certainly understandable, is that you end up a lot of times with this stair-stepping on rounded edges or angled edges because of the layering, right? Well, another thing you can do to increase resolution is to print at thinner layers, okay? Most printers working at a nominal level print at about 0.2 millimeters per layer.
You can only do that if you go with the smaller nozzle, obviously.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, and if you combine, so now if you go down from, say, 0.2 millimeters down to, say, 0.606 millimeters, okay, that's one third of the regular layering that you would normally do. Okay, now you're tripling the number of layers, which makes it much more smooth. Okay. But again, now the printer, every time it has to go and do a layer, it's got to do it three times.
Well, it's just like digital sampling, right? I mean,
exactly.
Remember when CDs first came out and they were judged a little harsh?
Mm-hmm.
Once they started increasing the sampling rate, that stair step, that square wave, the little square waves of the sine wave started to get a lot more palatable to the ear.
Exactly. So, you know, we live and learn, we make adjustments, right? So let's say you've got that 0.25 nozzle and you're printing at 0.06 layer height. Well, now you've gone from taking an hour to print 20 windows. Now you've gone to 6 hours to print those windows.
Yeah.
Because you're adding an extra couple hours because you're putting less plastic down at any time and you're doing three times more layers. Okay?
Jeez.
So it adds that. And now wait, I'm not done.
Wait, there's more.
Exactly. It turns out also that in order to get the finest possible resolution, okay, one of the things that you want to do is you want to print at a slower speed, because higher speeds tend to cause vibration and will cause a wavy appearance in the plastic as it's being put down.
Huh.
So a good speed for regular printing is usually around 70 millimeters per second, which is pretty fast. But for the type of printing that I'm doing for really high resolution, I usually knock that down to about 30 millimeters or 25 millimeters a second. Now do the math on that. Now you're talking about 10 to 12 hours to do 20 windows.
Sounds like you've used a lot of plastic in trial and error to come to all of these conclusions.
Oh, you have no idea.
Now, is it fairly inexpensive, the plastic?
It is. The plastic is very inexpensive, actually. For the most part, I'm using this plastic called PLA, which stands for polylactic acid. And it's actually a green product. It actually breaks down in the sun. It's actually made from plant products, actually.
Does that mean the finished product has that same characteristic?
It can. You have to be careful not to leave it in the sun or it'll degrade.
Wow. So you don't use this for garden railroading.
No, you really don't. In fact, actually, funny story, just to get off on a tangent for just a moment. I actually, when I first got the printer, my wife had a couple of these garden lights that were like LED things that had batteries in them. And they
would turn
during the day and then come on at night. And they'd broken. And I made brackets to actually fix them for her. And we put them out and she was all happy, you know, like that. And about a month after that, it started getting warm because it had been the spring, and then it started getting in the summer. And every day they would warm up and they'd get a little too warm and they'd start wilting. And by the end of the summer, they were all bent over.
Wow.
So that was part of it. And also the other thing about PLA is it's fairly low temperature. Its melting point to actually do most of this printing is about 200 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm not sure what
that would be. You could not toss it into boiling water.
Yeah, I mean, it would still hold up kind of. It would get soft in boiling water for sure.
Yep.
It wouldn't go liquid, but it would get soft. But it's a great plastic. It only costs about $20 to $25 for 1 kilogram spool. Okay, and a 1 kilogram spool actually lasts quite a while. I probably use for, say, one of those windows that I did, I think it uses about 30, 40 centimeters. So like half of a meter. Okay. And there's, I don't know how many meters there are on a spool, but I could do thousands of windows with a spool.
Wow.
Oh yeah. That's, and it's, so when you really come down to, when you're making a model, like that penny cage that I did, I think I probably have about 10 cents worth of material in it.
Well, all right. So the question I always think of when I listen to the enthusiastic 3D printers such as yourself is, okay, fine. You're a developer. You've got that skill set. What about for mere mortals? You know, what would the learning curve be like for somebody who is not a developer, you know, not a programmer, to be able to use the software to try to make something they wanted to make?
Well, that's an excellent question. I would say that, I mean, obviously, like you said, I'm a tinker, I'm an inventor, a frustrated engineer. I want to learn all this stuff.
Sure.
That's what really turns my bolts. You know, I mean, I really enjoy digging into it and pushing this machine as far as it'll go. You know, basically, and just trying to, you know, because I spent less than $200 on it. I've probably put $200 or $300 into improvements into it.
You don't sleep a lot, right?
Not as much as I like. But so I admittedly, I'm, you know, really pushing this pretty hard. But there are, for someone who wanted to spend a little bit more money than I did, you can get now some very, very high quality 3D printers with not the greatest amount of build space, but enough to build a small, like a 40-foot HO scale boxcar, right? You can get what's called, like the kind of printer that I have is an FDM printer. It's got the filament that comes in and heats it and it squishes it out and builds things up that way. There's another type of printer that you can get now called, and it's called an Anycubic Photon, okay? And the Anycubic Photon is a resin printer. It's an SLA printer, stereolithography. And the difference is that it comes with a tub inside it and a plunger. The plunger goes down into it, and then at the bottom of the tub is a glass plate, and underneath that there's either a laser or an LCD screen, okay? And it projects up onto the bottom of the tub ultraviolet light, which then cures a little bit the resin that's in the tub. The plunger comes down and sticks to the resin, and it comes back up and lets resin flood in underneath it again. And then what'll happen is that the laser will shoot the next layer, okay? And it just keeps doing this again and again. It keeps coming down, picks up. And so instead of building from the bottom up, like an FDM printer, an SLA printer starts from the top down. So you're building it straight out of the bottom and up. And the resolution on these printers is something on the orders of 10 microns. You can't even see. Like a lot of times people get a 3D printed part and you can see the stepping and everything. And it's a little bit rough. You can't believe the resolution that comes out of these machines. It's insane. It looks like it's been injected molded.
Now,
it's,
are these high-priced items?
Well, there are certainly some out there that are high-priced. For instance, there's the Form Labs Form 2, which is considered a very good printer, and that goes for about $3,500. But the Anycubic Photon, which came out, I think it's almost a year old now, it only runs for $450.
Which that's affordable by anybody that's remotely serious about this.
That's exactly it. And the results, okay, that you get out of it are just unbelievable. So for that kind of money, you can get results that are very nearly what you'd expect to get from injection molding.
But isn't the – when I speak of learning curve, I always think software, right? Isn't that the thing you get – the hurdle you have to get past?
It is. Yes and no. If you're willing to work from other people's models, because like I said, there's a website called Thingiverse and there are other ones too, where you can go on there and you can find models that people have created for railroad cars, for houses, for drink cozies, for handles, for a coffee pot, you name it. You can probably find it. Thingiverse itself has over 1.3 million items that you can download. Okay, for everything that you can imagine, cosplay stuff and little, D&D figurines, you name it, they've got it.
You pay some minor amount for each of these designs?
It's free. Everything is free.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to, you can tip somebody, say, hey, thanks, you know, throw them a couple of bucks.
Yeah.
There's a method to do that, but you can download anything there for free. Wow. And print and make as many copies as you want.
So it's really open source.
It really is open source. It's amazing. And so if you want to go that route, you know, you don't have to do a thing in terms of the software. All you have to do is download the model and then run it through a slicer program, which usually comes with your printer. And that basically takes the 3D model, which is an STL file, and converts it into G-code, which is instructions that the printer can understand. G-code also, by the way, is what CNC milling machines use.
It's a printer driver.
It's a printer driver. So it'll take that information and it'll slice it out into as many layers as you need to do, and it'll give the instructions to the printer, you know, go here, go here, go here, extrude along these lines, and yada yada yada, and it will just build you your model. Okay,
now you're so, in tech. I'm in tech. How well does this software work?
You know, it actually works pretty well.
Really?
I'm you know, early on, I gotta tell you, I've been doing this for probably 10 years. The very first printer I ever bought was a MakerBot Thingomatic Cupcake, which was a very crude printer made out of laser cut plywood.
Okay?
It's stone knives and bearskins.
Yeah.
The plate was only 4 inches by 4 inches, and you could do a model about 3.5 inches tall. That's tiny.
I get
right?
the Star Trek reference in that, by the way.
Good. I'm glad. okay. So you had that, and the resolution was frankly terrible. Okay. I think it had a 0.25 or 0.3 layer height, and I think it used a 0.4 millimeter nozzle. But the resolution really wasn't very good. It was a kit. I had to build it myself. It took me 20 hours to build it.
Jeez.
And it cost me over $1,000.
Talk about bleeding edge.
Yeah, it really was. And that was considered cutting edge at the time for home, you know, home use.
Right.
I think I managed to maybe get about 10 hours of printing on it before the thing self-destructed. The whole nozzle melted. It came apart. It was plastic everywhere. It was ugly.
That's an expensive little lesson.
It was an expensive lesson, absolutely. So, you know, it took a while before I went and did it again. But then about a year and a half ago, I bought this, you know, kit printer, which was called the Anet A8. It's a very popular entry-level printer. I was able to put the whole thing together in about 4 hours. And within, I'd say, an hour, hour and a half of putting it together, following YouTube videos and things like that, I had the thing printing fairly well. And I was actually really encouraged. And then I was like, okay, well, I printed out a couple of enhancements. I put out some braces to help keep the frame stiff, and a couple of things to make it do other things easier. After a while, after about a couple of months, I had it actually printing very well. And I'm like, this is actually really nice. I'm really enjoying this. You know, as you can imagine, one of the things that I really wanted was to make my own models. I was making stuff, downloading from Thingiverse, just like anybody else would. But I was really interested in trying to do my own stuff. And so I was looking around. Jim Lincoln, who I know you know, good friend
of
ours. Jim Lincoln is a big proponent of software called SolidWorks.
Yes.
Which is an amazing program.
Powerful.
Very, very powerful. But it costs thousands of dollars. It's crazy expensive, and it's worth every penny from what I understand.
Well,
but,
isn't it like trying to learn AutoCAD too? I mean, you know, it's heavy duty.
It's very heavy duty. Yes. So I was like, well, you know, that's great, but I'm not doing that. So what I did was I cast around and I found out there's a couple of very good free options. One of which is oddly enough by Autodesk, and it's called Fusion 360. And Fusion 360 also costs thousands of dollars, but there's a thing where if you are a startup or a hobbyist, you can download a 1-year license for it for free.
Wow.
$0. And it's renewable every year. So it is essentially high-powered free software.
Jeez. Is that what you're using now?
That is what I'm using. And there are, no joke, hundreds, if not thousands, of videos on YouTube that explain exactly how to do everything that you need to do. Okay? There's a guy named Lars Christensen who has done probably, I think, almost 200 videos already. And he goes through and he's got at least a dozen and a half absolute beginner videos where it'll take you to, you know, okay, here's where you start, here's what you do, and here's how you make a box, here's then you give it height, here's how you cut a hole in it, you know, and he's got, and every one of these things, you learn them, you just follow along and you do what he's doing, and all of a sudden it just starts clicking into place. You know, I'm not going to say that it's something that you can pick up in 20 minutes, but I spent some time, you know, I'd say in about 10 hours worth of practice and following videos, I got to the point where I was somewhat competent with it. And after another 10 to 20 hours, I'm doing things I never expected to be able to do. Getting back to what I was saying a minute ago, I started with this and my goal was eventually to build models with it. And I've gotten to the point now where I have gotten the printer dialed in well enough and I've learned enough about Fusion 360 that I can actually model a boxcar. In this particular case, I did an 1888 Michigan Central wood-sided boxcar, and I modeled 90-something percent of it on the 3D printer as a flat kit, and then pick all the parts off, put them together, and I have a really high-quality model that I'm perfectly proud to have out there on the railroad, and it looks like a resin kit.
So you've achieved critical mass with this, basically.
I think I have. You know, and I'm really happy with it. I'm actually at the point now where I think, like you were saying, I think at this point I can probably build almost anything.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've been working at this for less than a year, and I only work on it probably about 3 or 4 hours a week. You know, so if it's something anybody's interested in, it can be done. You know, and even if you're not at the highest like that, you can do this and you can get it to the point where you're just, you know, building things that other people have designed, and you can do a lot with that. I mean,
this sounds like your next clinic, Craig.
You know, as a matter of fact, part of what I was doing today at work, again, since it was quiet, is I was working on my next clinic, which happens to be exactly this. So
now, will that be at any RPM, or are you doing something in between?
I believe the first time I'm going to give it is probably going to be at the clinic up in the RPM show up in Connecticut.
Yep.
Which I can't remember. It's not Enfield anymore, right? Where are they?
No,
now?
It's I know the answer to this.
Okay.
But I can't think of it.
Well, we'll figure it out and we'll dub it in later.
It's the town. It's the exit I used to take to go to Collinsville.
There you go.
So if anybody knows that, yeah, I think
in the show notes. How about?
Yeah, that? I think they have a. I think they feel like they've got a bigger and better venue. So.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. They sound pretty excited about it. So yeah. I'll be doing it there. I'll also be doing it in the fall at the New England Region Convention for the NMRA. I'll be doing it there.
Where's that being held?
Syracuse, actually. So I'll be heading up to Syracuse. I think it's in September. Yep. And I'll be doing it there. And I have to talk to the people at the National, but I'm supposed to go to the NMRA National this year in Salt Lake City. And I'm not currently scheduled to do that clinic, but I'm going to talk to them about it if it's ready in time, and I'm going to try to do it there.
Wow. So, you know, I listen to you talk about things like that, and I feel like a slacker.
And I listen to the things you talk about, and I've got a bridge on my railroad that's – it was very interesting because I actually got a similar situation to what you're dealing with your gate, in that over the holidays, my wife – while I was actually out of town at a job site, my wife had some workmen come in to take care of something, and they actually broke one of my drop bridges.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah. And I was like, oh, man. So it's all mangled up, and I got to replace it.
The funeral for the worker?
Oh, God. Well, fortunately, he was long gone by the time I got home.
Oh, man.
I got home, and I was like, what? So, anyway, but...
There is no work that's...
since November, and I still haven't fixed it yet.
There is no work that's done by outside parties here where I'm not there hovering.
Oh, believe me, I would have been if I could have been.
Yep.
You know, and actually, it was the kind... I don't even remember specifically what it was, but it's the kind of thing that I probably could have done myself if I'd been home, but it was an emergency. And well, there's nothing I can do.
Since you're one of these guys that basically knows everything I don't know, I figured I would also ask you what you knew about signaling systems.
Oh, boy, signaling systems. Admittedly, I don't know a lot. I have had some discussions with some friends, and a good friend of mine named Jim Schweitzer has actually been working on a system for a friend of his, and we talk about that a couple times a month, probably. So I've gotten some insight into it.
You're probably wondering why I'm even asking about that, because I have
why would Mike be asking me about
I have
this?
a dark, you know, I have a previously dark railroad, but the portion of my railroad that exists now will remain dark territory, because I guess it was Hurricane, I want to say Agnes, that wiped out the signal system on that portion of the line, and they never rebuilt it. So anything north of Pittston was dark territory until you got to Sayre.
Gotcha.
But everything I'm building on my layout is now south and somewhat north of Pittston, and the whole Lehigh line was signaled, including Pittston Junction, and the DNH was signaled, and I'm building the interchange between the Lehigh line and the DNH at DuPont, and that's all signaled. So all of a sudden, I've got this learning project on my hands, trying to figure out how the heck I'm going to do this.
I see.
Happily ignored all things signaled all of these years, you know, and now I've got to do like this crash course in it. And I had a friend of mine come over that is a road foreman that definitely knows his signals.
Okay.
And my buddy, his name is Dennis Drumheller, and he's a pro for the railroad. And my buddy Dave, who just retired from the railroad as a dispatcher, he knows what he's talking about. So these two guys proceeded to spend about 2 hours talking about the issues with signals in the Lehigh line while I stood there with my mouth slightly agape.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Very much squashed like a bug by this conversation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where when they left, I just thought, I don't see how I could do this.
No, I'm sure you'll be able to. I mean, the only thing I can offer, really, is that from a modeling perspective, now, as I recall, you are an NCE person?
Yes.
In terms of control system? Right. Yes. Okay, good. Well, there's a few things that might be helpful for you. First of all, there's a number of different devices that I think NCA makes, and I forget exactly what they're called, but basically it's like a stationary decoder type of thing, but
sure.
They're specifically designed, if I remember correctly, to handle switches. I think they're called switch hits or something like that. I don't know.
But no, I've heard of them, yep.
Yeah, and they're designed in order to be able to help drive signals, because they've got lots of outputs for the different aspects. And as far as I know, that's what they're using on my friend's layout. And
well, I mean, as you know, you can take this as far as you dare.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
I mean,
oh, you can go absolutely.
We're talking about, you know, what you're talking about, I think, would be using your controller to throw a switch, which throws the signals, which is the opposite of what happens in the prototype.
Yeah,
right?
Actually, no, that's not where I'm getting at.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I agree certainly that it's a possibility, but actually what they do is they're using the DCC system in order as a bus in order to send the signals back and forth.
Okay.
Okay. But everything is controlled by JMRI. Now, have you heard of that? Do you know what that is?
You've got a computer sitting there.
Yes. Okay, so there's a computer with a screen, okay, that has the schematic of your railroad, and you build that out using tools that are built into the program, but you do all the logic for whether or not a signal should go yellow or red or green, depending on what the interlocking is doing.
Sure.
Okay. And you're getting feedback from the railroad in terms of detection, which trains are where. And so all the logic actually is done by a computer running JMRI, which then, once it figures out everything it needs to do, it sends commands out to all these controllers that actually sit around the railroad, and then, you know, changes the aspects of the signals depending on what's actually got. But you need feedback from the switches to know what position they're in. You need feedback from detection to know where the trains are.
So the switch feedback is coming from whatever you're using to actually throw it, right?
Right. Like if you have a tortoise, you're probably going to use the auxiliary contacts in order to feed back to the computer what position it's in, whether it's normal or reversed. And that's going to go into some sort of a board that's going to have input and output in order to say, okay, you know, if it's live, if you got a high signal, it's going to be straight. And if it's going to be low or off, then it's going to be reversed.
This doesn't sound like a Saturday afternoon project.
No, it's definitely not simple, but it is doable. It is definitely not a Saturday afternoon project, but and it's with no doubt about it, it's involved.
It would
But
be very, very cool and very, very prototypical. And that aspect
yes.
of it appeals to me a lot.
Yep.
I don't want to get bogged down in it,
Yeah.
and in part, some of it is too much like work.
Oh, I hear you. I mean,
So,
unless you really like solving puzzles, which is, really what this is like the ultimate puzzle. Because what you got to do is you got to sit down, you got to figure out where the interlocking is, where the limits of it are, and then for each track, depending on each system, exactly where, depending if this happens, what do I do here? If that happens, what do I do there? It's really it's like I watched my friend Jim working on this stuff, and I see him build these huge truth tables, which I know you know what that is. And it's just a huge matrix, and it figures out, okay, well, if this happens and this happens, then this has to happen. And it's like you said, it's enough to make you sit there with your mouth wide open like you were talking to your friend Dave. But it can be done.
Well, I'm hoping that I can leverage the interest and abilities of some of these guys without being wholly dependent upon them, if you
Yeah,
know
and
what I'm
that's a
saying.
good point because you got something you got to be able to maintain yourself,
Yeah,
or
and
if you're
people,
in trouble.
somebody gets hit by a bus, you don't want your entire layout to be non-useful, you know?
Right. Now let me ask you a question about it. Do you know in this area what type of signaling was? For instance, was it ABS or was it just dispatcher controlled CTC? Do you know what it actually was in terms of the way that the trains were controlled?
I'm pretty sure that it was CTC in that area.
Okay, CTC makes it a little tougher, but it's not the end of the world. Because if you had ABS, you could actually set it up. I know that there's some circuits that you can buy. Boy, I wish I could remember the name of the company that does it. But some very simple stuff where basically you just put a module at each place where you have signals, and then they connect to each other and with detection. And so, like if let's say you've got a train moving through several blocks. As it comes into a block, it'll be detected, and the signal for that block will go red, and it'll send a signal to the next controller, which then will drop the other one to yellow, right? And then the next one is still green, and if it moves into the next block, that one drops from yellow to red, and the next one drops from green to yellow, and so on and so forth.
And that's basically how the prototype works when they have
Right.
that methodology.
That's exactly right. But that's ABS. That's a, it's an automatic signaling, right? It's automatic block system is what ABS stands for. But CTC is something different. It's actually controlled by the dispatcher, and it has some of its own rules, but a lot of it is based on the fact that the dispatcher has to set a route, usually on a board or in a computer, and then hits, commit, and then it'll automatically set all those things, and the route will become on with, green lights for the route that the dispatcher has set for a specific train. So it's a lot more involved, it's a lot more complicated, but again, it can be done. If you were doing ABS, it would be simpler. But since that's not what you have, you got to go with what you got to go with.
Well, I mean, it would be very cool to be able to do it the right way because although you haven't seen the new setup yet, the DuPont interlocking is basically in the old room across from Mehoopany. But it's going to interact with the interlocking that'll be at Pittston Junction, which is kind of like the opposite end of the new room and nowhere near it and nowhere really in sight of it. You know what I mean? So to have something that is prototypically interacting with something elsewhere would be awesome.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Oh, and there's one other thing that is relatively recent, and if you've been following stuff that's going on in the NMRA recently, you might know a little about it, and that's this LCC thing they have, which layout control, type of thing.
I know nothing about that.
I know very little about it myself, but my understanding of it is that it's supposed to be a separate bus, meaning a communications thing, that it's supposed to handle things like this to keep it off of the throttle bus. Okay? Because once you have a lot of things, especially on a layout your size, once you have a lot of trains running on it, and there's an awful lot of traffic going forth with commands to locomotives in order to speed up, slow down, blow the horn, do whatever like that, flash the dish lights. when you start throwing in a lot of commands for things like throwing switches or changing signal aspects, that really can slow that network down. It's not a fast.
We're actually running into bandwidth issues on that bus, really?
Yeah, it can actually happen. Yeah, especially when you start throwing more stuff onto it. So that's right. Why they've developed this LCC thing. It's a separate but similar bus that is designed to work with components that you can plug into it for things like what we're talking about, for switching, for signaling and things like that. And a lot of the companies are developing specific boards that are designed to work on the LCC bus that usually work with a computer or with some sort of a black box, depending on what you're trying to do, that'll actually do, you know, the things that we're talking about.
Gee, maybe once my timing won't be bad.
No, I think it actually might be good. It actually could work out very well for you. That, like I said, I don't know a lot about it myself, but I do know that that's what the whole thing is geared towards.
Yeah. Well, so, in your travels, if you run across anything that's a good treatise on the subject, feel free to send it my way if you think of it.
Oh, I absolutely will. In fact, I remember a few months back in one of the NMRA, what do they call it now? NMRA magazine, I guess.
The Bulletin? Was that the...
It used to be the Bulletin, and they changed it a few years ago. It's now called NMRA. But I think almost every month now, they do some sort of a small article on LCC. And I think there was one a few months back where they were actually talking about this kind of thing. What are the different components that are available and how to use them? And if I can locate it, I'll send it to you.
See, this makes me think, all right, what else don't you know about that you need to know about?
Well, oh, there's too much. We can't know everything.
You know, when you think about it now, I mean, I'm self-employed. I've been self-employed forever, and I'm as busy as I ever was. But because I make my own schedule, I can sort of run my day efficiently. You know, there's not a lot of wasted time in a given day or even a given week. Not everybody can exist with that level of uncertainty in their life, but it's like the only thing I was ever cut out to do. So I've you know, at this advanced age here, I mean, I got it down. So
exactly.
So given that, I look at everything that's going on. You know, I mean, I'm doing installs all the time. I'm working on the layout. I'm working in the business. I'm you know, everything else that everybody does. And I think, where am I going to fit all this extra stuff into that schedule? What's going to go? You know, what has to go? And you know, I've got a pretty ambitious layout build project going here.
Yeah.
And, you know, and my wife said to me, she said, you know, don't rush it. You know what I mean? Part of the reason you did this was to have something to do. And I said, no, I keep telling people, that is not why I did this. The reason I did it is to have the layout I always wanted to have. You know,
there you go.
Based on what I know now. You know, I mean, I think I finally have operated enough on other people's layouts and have run my own enough, and I understand my prototype enough that I think I finally have figured out what I actually want.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just figured, you know, at 63 or whatever the heck I'm about to be, why wait? You know what I mean? I don't want to wait till I can't see or I can't, you know, bend over to work on the layout. You know what I mean? I want to you know, get going on it. But by the same token, the mandate is I must enjoy the process of doing it. You know, otherwise it's fruitless. And the whole purpose of this is to enjoy what you're doing.
Right. If you're not enjoying it, you're doing it wrong.
I completely agree. You know, so I'm always I get like a warning sign when it's something that feels like work.
Yeah. Okay.
But sometimes it's a means to an end. You know, not when I was stripping shingles off the side of my house with a flat-edged shovel, that wasn't fun. But it was a means to an end to get the addition going. You know what I mean? So sometimes you have to bite the bullet and do something that's a little less fun in order to have more fun later.
Yep. No doubt about it.
Yeah, sounds that. Well, something tells me we will have more conversations about this down the road.
I certainly look forward to it. I mean, for me, with the LCC stuff, I haven't paid much attention to it because doing an 1890s railroad, there's very little, you know, there's no signaling.
Right.
There's basically no electricity.
But so, as a guy who's interested in everything, you have a mandate to learn about
and
this.
See, there you go. And that's exactly what it is. I'll get the bug and I'll start learning about it. And then I'll find somewhere to actually apply that knowledge. And, you know, who knows, that might end up being you.
Was there really zero signaling in your era?
Well, not zero. In fact, actually, there's evidence that there were hall signals or banjo signals that were actually used on the Housatonic before it became part of the New Haven. And actually, that's a project I've got going on the back burner. I've been trying to use, well, I was trying to actually, I built a model and I tried to make castings of it, of working hall signals. I was trying to do that. And then it really wasn't working out very well. So now it's another project on the burner of things to do with the 3D printer. Because now that I have a much better idea of how this all works, I tried to start doing it one about 7 or 8 months ago and it was a dismal failure. And but now I think I understand enough about what I want that I can probably whip it out in a couple of hours and I can make as many as I need. So I think one of the things that we're probably going to end up using it for, because I can't imagine anywhere else I'd need it. But on my layout, there's an area where the system goes from Bethel, Connecticut, up through and past Danbury, up to New Milford, Connecticut. Okay. And part of that is that there was an area on the railroad, which I call the Danbury Diamond, which is where the railroad split into two at Bethel. It went one way, it went to the west, it went into Danbury, and the other way, it went east and went into, shoot, what's the name of that yard? Hawleyville Yard. Okay.
Okay.
And Hawleyville was actually a yard that was run by the New York and New England, but, you know, it was kind of a joint thing. And there were tracks then that went from Hawleyville up to New Milford, and there was also a connector that went from New Milford to Danbury. So it basically it became like a diamond there,
Okay.
almost separated by several miles each track, but they were there. Well, one of the things that we have to do is we have a cutoff, which was also a real thing. It went across the center of the diamond, which allowed trains on the main line to go from Bethel directly to New Milford without passing through either Danbury or Hawleyville. So we have that cutoff on the layout. But one of the things it's was the thing is that trying to keep people out of the yard in order to leave the yard master some room to switch.
Sure.
And so one of the things we want to do is we want to set up signals on either approach to the yard coming out of Bethel and coming out of New Milford in order to say if the signal is lit, wait here.
Sure.
Don't come into the yard. So we're probably going to end up using hall signals for that. And they will actually have motorized. I don't know if you know how a hall signal worked. Basically, it was like a big wooden banjo type of thing, and it had a hole in the middle. And it basically you would see straight through it. And so during the day, there was a big white hole in the middle of the target. And when they wanted it to go red, they'd pull a crank, and it would pull up a frame with a piece of red silk stretched over it. And so what you'd see then is that you would go from white to a dark red because it was silk. You'd see some light through it.
And at night,
Okay.
they'd have to put a lantern or something in it.
At night, they had a small lantern that they hung up behind it, and there was a small roundel on the front in red. And the same mechanism that would move the frame up and back and forth would cover up the lens or let it open.
Wow.
So it was both lighted and a physical flag that went up inside it that was red or clear. I'm hoping to have exactly the same thing. I want to put a micro LED in the top of it in order to show the indication. I also want to have it actually operate and have a frame that moves up and down inside it in order to show that red or clear signal.
And
And
you'll just make it.
I will just make it. And I already know how I'm going to do it too. This is one of several hundred projects sitting on my workbench.
Very, very inspiring, Craig. This to me is the hallmark of an active mind. I expect
Thank you
nothing
very much.
less.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, I really appreciate your filling in for my faithful companion, Mr. Mason, and hopefully you'll be willing to do that again someday. And
Time, absolutely. And my best to Scott, and thank you for the opportunity,
yeah,
you know.
I'll look forward to seeing you at least at the next meet. Now, are you doing any articles lately, or?
Nothing that's in the hopper yet, but who knows? Anything could be happening.
Yep, I got you. So that's a very non-committal answer. I got
Yeah,
it.
right now I don't have anything going, but I did get a message from what is his name? The gentleman who just took over RMC.
Otto.
Otto, yes. I got an email from Otto the other day asking if I had anything that I might be able to submit, so I might put something together for him.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, Enjoy the rest of your evening. I assume you
Thank
have
you, sir.
several more hours of work ahead of you tonight. And I know I do. And thanks, everybody. And we will see you hopefully next month.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.